Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
I need you to come and help me. I need a deeper experience with you than I've ever had before. Come down upon me and fill me with yourself.
Now that we're at this time where the world really is at an end, I'm very, very grateful.
This isolated dirt road leads to a group of people who are waiting for the world to end.
People who don't receive me will be lost and destroyed. People who accept my testimony will be saved.
And this is the man who's left in there. He calls himself
L. Ron Hustler.
Joining me today on the Peter B. Collins podcast and in a special report for Newsbud is Ron Miscavige. And our opening music today is from Topper and DJ Quest. The song is called L. Ron Hustler. And Ron Miscavige spent a good part of his adult life in the Church of Scientology. And his son, David, is now the worldwide leader of the Church of Scientology. And in a new book called Ruthless, Scientology, My Son David Miscavige, and Me, Ron Miscavige tells all. He explains some of the behind-the-scenes activities. He talks about his own role in the Church of Scientology, where he was part of the so-called Sea Org, which is the highest level of the people who run Scientology. And he's got quite a bit to tell us. And joining me today in the secret studio is my longtime friend and colleague, Ford Green. And Ford has been covering these issues since the 1970s, when he helped people escape from the Unification Church, the Moonies. And Ford, you have successfully sued Scientology in a number of cases. We'll talk perhaps about some of those as the conversation unfolds today. Ron Miscavige, why did you write this book?
I'll tell you, Peter, I wrote the book to do something that is effective against their toxic policy of disconnection. As a matter of fact, it is the only reason I wrote the book, because I lost my family through this particular policy. My daughters do not talk to me anymore, nor my grandchildren, nor my great-grandchildren, some, as a matter of fact, most of which I have never met.
Well, not only that, your son sends private detectives to conduct a very, very close surveillance on you.
Peter, let me tell you something. I left on March 25th in 2012. I should say I escaped, because that's the proper word. And I did not know this. I had one little incident that should have been a red flag for me or put my antenna up, but I didn't pay attention to it. We left on March 25th, 2012, and we were staying with my mother-in-law in Whitewater, Wisconsin. And her mailbox is about 30 yards from the front of the house. There's a big space there, a lawn. And I went out one day to get the mail, and there was a guy there in a black van. And I said, "Can I help you?" And the window was down. It was summer. He says, "No," he says, "I got the wrong address." And he continued writing something down, and he drove off. That actually was Dwayne Powell, the PI, who was following me with his son, Daniel. These guys were paid $10,000 a week to report on me between 8 o'clock in the morning and 8 o'clock at night on all of my activities. I would go to the Whitewater Library to get on the internet, because my mother-in-law was not a digital champion. You know, she didn't even have internet. They'd walk in back of me and look at on the screen to see who I was writing to. They followed me around to stores. They watched me and sent reports in. daily between 8 in the morning and 8 o'clock at night. And one day, and this is critical, I should tell you this in case your listeners might not know it. One day I was shopping at a grocery store called Aldi's in Janesville, Wisconsin, and it was a summer day, and I had a pocket T-shirt on. Now, my cell phone was in the left-hand pocket of that T-shirt. Mm-hmm. So I went to the car with the groceries, took the bags out of the cart, and was putting them in the car, and I thought my cell phone was going to fall out, and I reached over to the left-hand side of my chest, exactly like that, to make sure I got it. The private investigators who were looking at me at the time called in to their contact and said, it looks like the target. They referred to me as the target. And Peter, just as an aside, when they caught these guys finally, when Nick Pye from the West Dallas police arrested them and opened up his trunk, they had a short amount of handguns. They had license plates from five different states. They had an 18 millimeter rifle, a 22 caliber rifle fitted up with a silencer, and over 1,000 rounds of ammunition.
And what is your arsenal, Ron? Besides being a suppressive person, you got a lot of guns there at your house to protect yourself from Scientology detectives?
Oh yeah, I have a Browning automatic rifle. I have a 9mm cannon, you know, an assorted amount, about 1,000 hand grenades. And listen, I stand on my own 2 feet, and I'll handle myself. I don't have an arsenal of weapons at all. I'm joking when I say that. You know that, Peter.
Right. Now you report in the book that these detectives reported this scene and suspected that you were having a heart attack, and that the police later told you that when they talked to these detectives, they explained that for the first time when they sent up this report that you might be keeling over and dying, that your son, David Miscavige, responded to them directly, the first time he'd ever interacted with these field detectives. And what did your son tell the detectives?
Well, here's what he told them. As I said, they called in because they didn't know what to do. They never ran into this before. They told their contact. Contact says, hang on a second, hung up. Within minutes, a gentleman came on the phone, identified himself as David Miscavige, and said to the PIs, listen, if it's his time to die, let him die. Don't intervene. Don't do anything. That's what he told the PIs, and that was reported by them on tape. Daniel Powell said this on tape, and if anybody's curious enough, you can go on the internet and listen to this. It's on several different sites where you can hear him say this. Mm-hmm. At that point, the son, Daniel Powell, said on the tape, at that point, he says, I refer to him as an animal. He says, if that was my father, I'd be on the first plane out of wherever I was to make sure he was okay.
Well, it certainly fits the definition of ruthless, Ron.
Well, I would say so. And then when Nick Pye, who was the arresting detective, called me up to the West Dallas police station. He said to me, he says, do you have any idea why they were following you? And, well, I said, I don't know, maybe, you know, because I'm the father of the chairman of the board of Scientology, they're afraid I might go to the media or something. And on the other hand, maybe David is a little concerned about my health. And Nick says, man, I don't know how the hell to tell you this, but, and then he told me what he said. And it was devastating. I just couldn't believe it. I just could not believe he would say that about me or not care about me to that degree.
Now, Ron, you started very early in the Church of Scientology. You were drawn to L. Ron Hubbard's writings back in the 1970s. You took your family to England to really immerse yourselves in Scientology. You joined the Sea Org, and later you spent more than 20 years composing music for Scientology videotapes and other uses. So you are deeply steeped in this whole organization, which many people regard as a cult. And Ford, did you want to ask him about his current status?
Well, actually, what I want to ask you about, Ron, is in reading your book, I noticed what I considered to be a pretty profound omission. And that is that you don't make any reference to Scientology's fair game policy. Fair game policy is a policy that where Scientology says that when somebody is a suppressive person, any means can be used to lie, sue. There you go. So I was wondering, lie, sue, trick, or otherwise destroy the the suppressive person without any Scientology justice procedures being applied to him or her. And I found that curious because that policy, in my understanding, is the main thing that the Scientology hierarchy, including David, your son, uses to go after suppressive persons. And I was hoping you could talk about that a little bit.
I will talk about that. And just to give it straight to your listeners, because you paraphrased it, which was pretty damn close. But this is a policy letter dated 18 October 1967, and it's called Penalties for Lower Conditions. And what you referred to was under the condition of enemy. If you're considered to be an enemy, there's an SP order, which means a suppressive person order, which, as you properly stated, and it says exactly, fair game, may be deprived of property or injured by any means by any Scientologist without any discipline of the Scientologist, may be tricked, sued to, lied to, or destroyed.
Wow.
That's exact quote from the policy.
Right.
Now, in answer to your question, first of all, I wanted the book to be as even-handed as possible. And I think it has achieved that. I don't know if either of you gentlemen read the book.
We've both read it entirely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I asked you the question, because I did read the book, and not seeing fair game in there just leapt out at me. I didn't quite understand it, but I'm understanding it now from what you're saying.
Right. In other words, I didn't want this to be, look what you did to me, you're horrible, I'm coming after you, sons of bitches. I didn't want it to have that ambiance to the reader. I wanted him or her or whoever is reading it to get that this is an accurate accounting of what goes on within the church, and let them be the judge. And I felt that that would increase the amount or type of reader who would latch onto this, and maybe the book would have its own legs. And it is doing that, and I'm getting very favorable reviews. The main thing is I want to do is get this book out to as many people as possible, so they can read about this and understand that that policy is a very toxic policy. And when they do that to a person, I don't think any cult, religion, outfit, company, anybody should be allowed to do that. I would like to see that policy discontinued. No. And that's why I didn't to any, you sons of bitches, you know, blah, blah, blah. I wanted it to be fair, and mm-hmm. I think I did achieve that, if I don't mind saying so myself.
Now, Ron, I'm a recovering Catholic, so I come out of the Christian tradition, and I have a very hard time reconciling that kind of militaristic take-no-prisoners punishment system with any kind of religious value system. And this calls into question the fundamental issue of whether Scientology is a church. And I am one of these people who does not believe that it is a religion. I don't believe that it qualifies for tax-exempt status as a church or religion under U.S. tax laws. And I believe that it is a cult. And under the control of your son, it has become almost a paramilitary organization as it applies to disciplining those who seek to leave Scientology.
Well, you have every reason to believe that. If you were expecting an argument from me, you're not going to get one. I will tell you, I think they are a cult. That's my personal opinion. You know, I'm not a tax attorney who's going to judge as to whether they would qualify to be tax exempt. But from my personal experience, I would say it is a cult. And I'm going to tell you something. For me to have to escape from there, think about that for a second. This is the United States of America. I literally had to escape. I had to plan out my escape for almost 6 months to make sure we could pull it off. And I go into great detail in the book, as both of you know if you read the book. Mm-hmm. When I review that book, I think, Jesus Christ, did I actually have to do that? The answer is yes, I had to. Because if I would have been caught trying to escape, I would have been sequestered from the rest of the group. My wife would have been kept from me, and we would have gone under interrogation every day on an e-meter. And then when we weren't doing that, we would be out pulling weeds or doing manual labor.
And Scientology has its own prison system, doesn't it?
Well, I guess you could call it that, the Rehabilitation Project Force. But when you say its own prison system, let me tell you something, guys. I lived on a base, on a compound in Hemet, California, okay? On that compound, there was a fence around it where there's motion sensors. There's barbed wire on the top of the fence that points out and it points in. If I wanted to send a letter out, I would have to leave that envelope opened, and security guards would read it and to see if it was okay for me to say the things I was saying. If I wasn't, then they would send it back. I'd have to rewrite the letter. If I wanted to make a phone call, there was no phone that I could use just to call out. I had to go through reception. And the reception would ask, well, why are you calling this person? What are you doing? And if it was a personal friend or family, I had somebody listening in on the extension to make sure I wasn't saying anything I shouldn't have said. If I wanted to buy some shaving cream or maybe a pair of underwear or some toothpaste, I couldn't drive off that base to go to a local Walmart. I had to buy it on the internet or the canteen that was on the base.
Now, Ron, let me stop you just for a second, because I'm located 2 miles from San Quentin Prison, the infamous home of death row in California. And the rules that you just described are very similar to the rules that people I know who are on death row live under. So there is a prison system in Scientology, and I believe that this deserves investigation by law enforcement officials, because I think that what you describe is that people are being held against their will.
Well, listen, as I said earlier, you're not going to get many arguments from me on this, because that's how I felt when I was there. I mean, it didn't. Look, the way this happens, the way you can get in that frame of mind is these things, these little liberties are taken away from you in very small increments. And I'll say it again, I go into detail on this in the book, where first of all, this is taken away, and okay, well, I'll agree to that, maybe that's okay. And then another little thing is taken away, and before you know it, you have built up a set of agreements in your mind that all of these things are okay. You've built your own mental prison. Now, Peter, I'm going to tell you the bad thing about that. Well, not that I have to tell you any more than that, but if you were to take a bus and drive it right through that gate and stop it and say to the people there, listen, if anybody wants to leave, get on the bus. We will give you cash to ford you over until you get going. We'll get you a job. We'll have a place to stay. We'll reconnect you with your relatives. Peter, I don't know if anybody would take them up on it.
They probably wouldn't take them up, Ron. Let me cut in here a little bit. You were a Sea Org member, right?
Yes.
And
for 26 and a half years.
For a really long time. And so for the listeners, the Sea Organization, and that's as in ocean, is basically a paramilitary group that's responsible for controlling all of Scientology. Is that a fair characterization based on your experience?
Yes, yes.
And so as a Sea Org member, my understanding is that not only do you commence your membership with the signing of a billion-year contract, but also Sea Org members receive special training, receive weapons training, receive martial arts training, receive other kinds of training that is really more specific to military or marine training than it is for operating a religious organization. Did that happen with you?
No. As a matter of fact, I don't know who started that. You don't receive weapons training, nor combat training, or any of those things.
Because the way I get that was from a there are Hubbard's. Hubbard's written everything in the world, and so you have Hubbard policy letters, you have executive directives, you have other things that are called issues, and there's a hierarchy of importance as to those. So it was in one of those that, while I was litigating against the church, that I read what the specifics were as to Sea Org training.
Okay, now don't take this wrong. I'm not doubting that you're telling me what you actually saw. I'm not doubting that at all.
Sure,
there's a lot
sure.
of things that L. Ron Hubbard wrote that were never carried out. And unbelievably, it could have been as simple as this. They didn't want to take the time to do it because you'd be off your regular post, and they wanted to keep you working at what you regularly are supposed to do.
Right. So
in
Scientology, it's comprised of hundreds of corporations with several that sit at the top. You have Religious Technology Center. You have Church of Spiritual Technology. You have Author Services. There are a number of other ones. Was it your experience as to the corporate structure of Scientology that all of those corporations were operated by Sea Org members, and all of the Sea Org members were obedient to the commands of your son?
Yes.
Yeah, it's really when Scientology talks about how it has different corporations and each one of them have corporate integrity, in other words, independence, that's largely a fiction. It's all run from one place, and it's the top, and it's David Miscavige that's calling the shots.
He runs all of it, and it's as simple as that. Yeah. I don't have to add anything to what you said. It would just be a waste of, well, not a waste, but I'd just be repetitive.
I'm curious about the transition of power that took place prior to the point where L. Ron Hubbard died. And as I understand, the way things worked was that the heir apparents to Hubbard were Pat and Annie Broker.
Yeah. Right.
And at that time, which was in the mid-80s, Scientology was having to field a lot of different lawsuits from ex-members such as Wallersheim and Julie Christofferson. They were having to deal with litigation regarding their tax status with the IRS. Right. There was a lot of litigation going on. And the way that I got the story from Rick and Vicki Aznarand was that what David, your son, did was to talk to the brokers and say, listen, if your identities are listed as in charge of corporations, you're putting yourselves at risk for being named in lawsuits. And in order not to be subject to being deposed and having your depositions taken under oath, and in order to insulate yourselves from having to waste your time dealing with lawsuits, let me put my name there and I will field any sort of lawsuits and protect you from that. Is that accurate?
Okay, this is what Vicki told you?
Yeah.
Now, I don't have personal knowledge of that. But
okay.
I've had inklings of that from various people, so I can't say that in fact did happen from my own experience. I wish I could, because to me it makes more sense than anything. But I'm going to tell you what I think happened.
Okay.
First of all, let me just go backtrack a little bit to earlier times. And I do want to say this, and I've said it in other interviews, and I'd like to say it now. David wasn't always this way. I mean, when he was a kid, he and I got along great. I got to tell you that. He had a great sense of humor. He was very smart. We had a lot of good times together. He was like a little firecracker. I admired many of the things that he could do. And one of them was, his sense of humor. It was great. And I think what happened to him, and if you can track with this, I think you'll see that what I'm saying is probably what happened. There was an Englishman by the name of Lord Acton who lived between 1843 and the early 1900s. He was a member of Parliament in England. He is the one that said, power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely, which I'm sure you both know of that and you've heard of it, right?
Sure, mm-hmm. Of course.
Okay. I think this is what happened to David. I think once he got in the Sea Organization, it was only 7 months before he was working with L. Ron Hubbard in California, where they were shooting movies showing the various technical aspects of Scientology. So he rose right to be with them.
And he was still a teenager. He was 17, 18 when he started working directly with Hubbard, right?
16, Peter.
16.
Listen, yeah, because before he turned 16, I came home from work one night, and he was in his room laying in bed with his kind of head on his hands like that, and I could see he was pondering something. I said, Dave, what's up, man? And he said, listen, Dad, I don't want to go to school. All the kids around me are taking drugs. I don't want to go with this stuff. I want to join the Sea Org. I want to help L. Ron Hubbard. That's what he said to me. And I thought to myself, I thought, you know what? When I was 17, I wanted to join the Marines, and that was my purpose, and I don't think I made a mistake. He's very capable at being an auditor. He's a very smart individual. I think he could make a good career out of it. So I said, okay, I'll help you in whatever way I can. So I helped him. I gave him, you know, money. I bought clothes for him and put him on a plane when he was 16. The day after he was 16, he went down to Clearwater, Florida. Within 7 months, he was working with L. Ron Hubbard. Mm-hmm. Now, there was an incident that happened some years later, and this is before L. Ron Hubbard died, where he had an asthmatic attack. And if you read the book, you know that I talk about that being the bane of his existence. Mm-hmm. He had an asthmatic attack and had to go to the emergency room. And when he came out of there, the person who took him there was waiting for him. His name was Paul. He said, Paul, he says, I just had a realization while I was in there. I realized that power is not granted. Power is assumed. And I think what he did at that point was just assume that position of being in power and start rising right up through the ranks, pushing people out of the way and setting it up so he could take over the church. And when L. Ron Hubbard died, that's exactly what he did. And as far as I know, there was never a directive, any note, any recording saying from L. Ron Hubbard that David is my successor. And I'll tell you this, guys. If you knew anything about Scientology, you know that everything L. Ron Hubbard ever said, wrote, he would have notes right next to his bed at night. He would record it. Everything he said was taken down. As a matter of fact,
Hubbard says, if it is not written, it is not true, right?
That's right. Exactly right.
And so then the way that I heard it is that, like I was saying earlier, that David positioned himself to have positions of authority in the higher constellation of corporations that govern Scientology, and then at a certain point, he and a lot of lawyers came. Earl Cooley, Michael Hertzberg, David Lieberman, the longtime lawyers that had represented Scientology, literally came in to RTC and to Religious Technology Center and took over. Were there any rumors like that or anything that confirming that you heard?
I can't say that there were. I've heard similar things, but, and I'm not taking this as an adversarial point of view against you, but
sure.
I don't know that to be true.
Yeah.
But I suspect it is true. I do.
Yeah.
That's just,
Did you know of an RPF location called Happy Valley?
Absolutely.
And because that was where, after David took over, Vicki Aznarán had been the Inspector General of Religious Technology Center. Her husband Rick had been the head of security worldwide there at the Hemet base, and so David RPF'd Vicki, and she had to run around a Dayglo orange telephone pole 12 hours a day for 90 days in a row.
Wow.
As well as, you know, eat the scraps and leftovers from the Sea Org guards that all the RPF people had to do and that kind of thing. And ultimately, the conditions for her were so poor that her uterus became infected. They wouldn't allow her to get any medical attention. And it was that physical emergency that drove her to have to escape in a way that was more coerced even than what you and Becky had to go through when you planned your escape.
Oh, I know that you have to have a hell of a plan to get out of Happy Valley. As a matter of fact, let me tell you something. When I first went to the Hemet base, that was a birthing place for Sea Org members, and I used to live there. So we would have to drive in the morning to go to work and drive back at night. And then it turned into, as you mentioned, as the RPF, where you had the running program.
Well, the running program.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's sold at Flag now as a service. I think it's called the Cause Resurgence Program. But in those days, even though L. Ron Hubbard gave it as a rehabilitating thing, I think it was done as a penalty. And because you don't have somebody in that goddamn Hammett sun which, by the way, the temperatures hit 110 and 115, running around in the middle of the day.
Let me ask you this about the suppressive person policy. As I understand it, according to Scientology ideology, I think it's 20% of the people in humanity are supposed to be suppressive persons. And then of that 20%, 2% of them are not rehabilitated. They're beyond hope. Is that accurate?
Oh, and I'll tell you what it is. You're close, but no cigar. Here's what it is. 20% of the population is considered to be potential trouble sources.
Got it. Or PTS.
PTS. That's right. And that means that in some way they're connected to and being affected by a suppressive person. And the percentage of suppressive persons is 2.5%.
Got it. Okay. You're right. I was close, but no cigar. So exactly. so then that segues us into something that I think's really part of what the thrust of your book is about, which is Scientology's employment of the policy of disconnection. That the disconnect policy is that when somebody is deemed to be PTS, deemed to be a potential trouble source, then the persons that are connected to that PTS person have to disconnect until the PTS person makes amends or goes through some sort of rehabilitation process where then they become safe in the eyes of their masters. Is that right?
Again, close, but no cigar again. Okay, now. If you leave, you're not declared PTS. You're declared a suppressive person.
You're an SP. Then you're subject to an SP declare.
That's right. Now, I had a friend in Philadelphia many years ago. He was a public person. He wasn't on staff or anything. And he said to me, you know, Ron, I think with the amount of all the suppressive declares that are being made, I think all the suppressives are in Scientology, which... He said it as tongue-in-cheek, but I'll tell you something. All these people, and of course, I've never been given a suppressive declare, but I am sure the church considers me suppressive. Leah Remini, who's a very good friend of mine, just from being with her at various shows we would do at the Celebrity Center, she's declared a suppressive. Jesus Christ, if you meet these guys, they're good people.
Right.
They have goodness in their heart.
Right.
The problem with that we're looking at here is this. The rank and file, almost all of these people come into Scientology with the desire, first of all, to help themselves, but then with the desire to help their fellow man.
To make the world a better place.
Exactly. That's wanting to help your fellow man. Look, I feed birds. Now, the squirrels have gotten in, and there's two ducks that come here to eat. Well, I don't know how the hell they found my place, but I have all kinds of I like helping little animals. And you'll find that, you know, Mike Rinder and, you know, Tom DeVocht and people like that, if you knew them personally, these people do not dramatize those traits as described by L. Ron Hubbard as a suppressive person. It's used as a tool. That's what's being, it's used as a tool to get you to be sequestered from the rest of the group. And if anybody talks to you, they'll be declared suppressive, well, and their friends won't talk to them.
It's even worse from that. Isn't it used as a tool to separate you from yourself? Because isn't everybody in Scientology on some level worried that they might be among that 2.5% of SPs that can't be saved, and that the auditing process, the interrogation process using the e-meter or lie detector is aimed at ferreting out connections that a person may have in this life to an SP, or maybe where they've been an SP at some time in a past life, they've been a guard at a Nazi prison camp or something like that. So everybody basically is kind of scared shitless that some auditor is going to say, you know, you're an SP, and then all of a sudden they're going to be subjected to all these draconian procedures. Isn't so the person's ultimately scared to think for themselves? Isn't that kind of how it works?
Well, what you're saying to a very large degree is true.
Okay, so he gets the cigar this time?
Yeah, but you get a small one, just a cigarette.
A Cipro.
It's not a Havana. I mean,
listen,
come on, man.
I'm gunning for a Miscavige.
Don't get so close.
I'm gunning for a miscavige.
There you go. Now, I think we might be getting a little bit too esoteric for the person who's listening to this, which is okay with me for a touch of it, but I don't want to go down that road too much.
Okay.
But I can tell you what keeps people in line, I think, is the fact that if they were to go on the internet and see something untoward about Scientology, or maybe talk to Mike Rinder, somebody's going to find out about it. And if they find out about it, they might declare them. And if they are declared, they'll lose their friends, their family. If they have a Scientology employer, they'll lose that job.
Right.
That's what the real fear is. And that fear is what drives people to kind of, even if they disagree with what the church is doing, a lot of them are what we call under the radar.
So, Ron, you spent more than 40 years in the Church of Scientology. You describe yourself as having escaped. Do you believe that you need deprogramming? Do you believe that they got such control over you that you have not been fully released from the clutches of this cult?
No, I don't feel I need deprogramming at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just feel that once I went on the internet and started looking at some of these things and speaking to people who were around L. Ron Hubbard when they were messengers, like on the ship, and hearing some of these things, mind you, not everybody is going to take the same approach as I did, but I was willing to eat crow. And I think if a person is unwilling to do that, they may have to have some other counseling where they spill their guts to it, and maybe by doing that, they air it out, and they'll. But they got to realize it for themselves. Mm-hmm. I realized this, that there were portions of Scientology when you first get in at the bottom of the bridge concerning your communication, how to improve that, how to divide life into eight parts so that you can look at where you're doing good, where you're not doing great, and you can improve it. Better your personal relationships. But as you go further and further in where you see that you're promised that you're going to become a superhuman, that you as a spiritual being can leave your body and operate without mechanical means, to me, I've never seen that achieved one time. Mm-hmm. That's a promise that's never been kept as far as I'm concerned. Now, then to think somebody other than me is going to guarantee my eternity as a spiritual being, Jesus Christ, guys, come to your senses. If a spiritual being is a quality, it's not a thing, it's a spirit. You tell me how somebody can say to you, okay, you did this course, now you're going to go to heaven. God damn, man. You know, well, just look in the mirror and say, do I actually believe this? But it takes a little bit of thinking, and it takes a little bit of comeuppance on your own part
right.
to realize. And what helped me, if I can just continue just for a slight more minute, because I know you want to ask me a question there.
Yeah, go ahead.
I researched this area of philosophical thought that took place between about 1850 and the early 1900s. And there were philosophers in those days that if you were a Scientologist and you read these references that I give in the book, you're going to find a lot of things that L. Ron Hubbard said in Scientology being spoken about by these guys, which is 75, 80 years prior to this coming out. And I think that is where he got his data. I don't think he got it from studying Spencer or Aristotle or Freud. I think he got it from that movement, because in the books, some of them have things exactly what he said. And these things you can pick up for 99 cents on the internet or download it for nothing, because they're past the point where they can be copyrighted anymore. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I feel that my study of that led me to believe, wait a minute, these are the things I know to be true. These are things I think are absolute BS. I tossed those away. And I can tell you, anybody who gets this book and reads those and takes the time to research this is going to lead a better life. And you don't have to spend $10,000 or $100,000 or $500,000 to do it.
Ron, let's go back even further than we have so far, because in the 1970s, I was hosting a radio show in Chicago. And at that point, there was a mystery about whether L. Ron Hubbard was still alive. And as you explained, the Sea Org was based on the years when he was actually at sea. He bought ships, and this was presumed to be a way to stay outside the reach of American lawsuits and courts. I'm just curious, because during that time, I believe that the mystique around that mystery, you know, is L. Ron Hubbard still alive, was used to market him and to create the mystery that led to more sales of the Dianetics books and his other writings. Give us your thought about what the view from inside was. You acknowledge in the book that you never actually personally met L. Ron Hubbard, but you certainly knew his whereabouts at many times when the general public did not.
Yeah. Okay, so in addressing that, I will say this. The fact that he was at sea and he had the Apollo and some other ships was not presented as a way for him to be out of the clutches of authorities seeking to capture him and bring him to justice in some things he was accused of. But it was done, and the public was told that in order to research these higher levels, you had to be away from the landmass, and you had to be at sea in order to accomplish this. And that was believed. Listen, when you get in this, and all these great things are being told to you, and what's happening when you first get in is that the stuff that you're given actually does work. It's simple things of self-help, but you think, well, if this is true, this upper level stuff must also be true. You don't think, hey, I'm being conned from the word go. But that was used as a bit of a mystique to keep you going for that elusive dream of being an operating Phaeton.
Speaking of, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
It's okay. I can stop.
So speaking of being conned from the word go, have you seen the South Park episode called Trapped in the Closet?
No, I actually haven't.
Because it's amazing. In half an hour, the South Park guys are able to really do a pretty thorough encapsulation of the entire ideology of Scientology. And if somebody was shown that at the outset of their recruitment into the group, chances would be they'd say, no, thank you. I don't want to end up in a place where I'm believing in Xenu and people being trapped in volcanoes and blown up by nuclear bombs and turning into body Thetans. And now I need to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to get Scientology processing in order to get rid of the BTs. Nobody would be likely to get anywhere near that, don't you think?
I'd have to look at it, but I have a tendency to agree with you. If it's put in a clever way, that would preempt them going into Scientology. But how about this for the Sea Org? What if somebody said to you, okay, now you're going to go to the highest place where you can go as a Sea Org member. We're going to check your mail before we send it out. If it's not okay, you got to rewrite it. If you want to talk on a telephone, you have to have somebody else listening in on another line, and you won't be allowed to get off the base on your own volition. You're going to have to buy things on the internet, and your work hours are going to be 9:30 to 12, lunch, muster at 12:30 to 5 o'clock work, 5:30, another muster, and then work till 9, 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night. Sign right here. Come on, guys.
You'd say, no, thank you. I'm out of here.
You don't even have to talk about it. You'd say, what the
and Ron, you know, you describe in the book not only those hours and musters and the prison-like setting, but that you don't even get Christmas off. And I got to ask, what is the work that is being done that is so urgent that there's no opportunity to give human breaks and that you've got to drive people to, almost exhaustion? What is the work?
Well, all of the work, in the earlier days, it wasn't that bad. When I first got in, I didn't particularly care for the discipline at all, but I felt I was doing something to help my fellow man. Sometimes at Christmas, we'd have 2 days off, go to Big Bear, go skiing. These things slowly but surely got worse. And it came to times later on where maybe for Christmas, we would work in the morning, have a nice meal, have a couple hours off in the afternoon and go back to work at dinner.
Okay, but what is the work? What the hell are you doing?
Okay, the work is being made important by somebody above you that it has to be done. This particular thing has to be done in order for us to forward the plans where we can make this particular org or church a better place to work at. And we need this immediately. It's got to be gotten out. That importance is put on by somebody above you, and you go along with it.
Isn't it tied, Ron, to the overall Scientology objective of clearing the planet, that is, making all people on Earth become Scientologists?
Yes. Now, let me clarify that a bit, because when I used to hear clearing the planet, I was over in the Channel Islands. This is in the 70s. I went with a Scientology officer to visit these people, and we wanted them to donate for services. And we flew over to the Channel Islands, and on the way back, I'm looking out of the airplane, and I look down, and I'm looking at England, and I'm saying, wait a minute, at the rate we're going, there are so many people. How in hell are we going to clear all these people? We don't have the facilities. That was a little bit of an antenna that went up for me. And then as far as clearing the planet, it wasn't that everybody had to be cleared, but you had to be in abeyance or so enamored with Scientology that you would listen to Scientology, and that would handle the same thing as if you cleared the planet.
Well, isn't part of the definition also, you talk about the definition of an SP or suppressive person in your book, but isn't the broadest definition is an SP is somebody who impedes the advancement of Scientology or any Scientologist? Yeah. And so really what you're talking about isn't that everybody in the world has to become a Scientologist. It's just that nobody should get in the way of Scientology. And if they do get in the way, then they're going to be declared an SP and perhaps subjected to the fair game policy.
That's actually a good point. I agree with you. That is a very good point.
Ron, I'm reading from the chapter of your book called The Whole, and you describe how in these manic episodes where you're planning for a big event, that people will work around the clock, and that you considered sleep deprivation to be something that David caused intentionally, because he could, you say. And you go on to say, I was never thrown into the hole, and neither was most of the gold staff. Nevertheless, the effects of the hole seeped into the organization and made life even more distasteful, if that was possible. David engineered this by throwing some or all of the gold executives into the hole for a couple of weeks. When they were released, they were expected to take the lessons they had learned during their incarceration and apply them to the rest of gold. Now, these are the systems that are common now at Guantanamo in the, you know, what's called enhanced interrogation, but I considered it to be a torture regime. So is Scientology involved in a level of torture of its members? And is David Miscavige directly micromanaging this?
Well, I don't know if you would call it torture, because I was there and I see how it's manipulated into being just enlightened as a better way to operate. And that's how it comes off. Because, listen, you can take, and, you know, this may sound like a firewood example, but I'm going to give it. Let's say your dad was mean to you or he did something to you. Now, it's 30 years later. Your father's been dead for 20 years, and you're still dramatizing and saying to people, if you only knew what my father did. In other words, it was done to you, but you will keep it up. So in doing this, putting people in the hole, it would be done to them, but they would keep up that modus operandi in handling another person when they come out. Does that make sense?
Well, sure. And there's also the ripple effect that by punishing a handful of people, the group gets the message that they have to conform as well.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you, when you're locked up that way, and those people on that base are not allowed to come and go freely, and I don't give a shit what anybody says. Oh, what, that's not true. Of course it's true. They'll deny everything. But when you're in that position, you have people fighting each other physically, just verbally abusing each other, you know, just ripping each other apart. You develop a different attitude toward life. Listen, I'll give you an example. I had what's called... Christ, I can't even think of the name of it now. I just lost what I was going to say. You know when you get an itchy skin?
Yeah.
Not scabies.
Eczema.
Eczema, psoriasis.
Mm-hmm. Eczema. I had eczema on my legs so bad that I used to scratch them at night, and our sheets would be bloody. I didn't even know I was scratching them that much. And I would go to a doctor in town with a minder that would go with me. And this doctor would say, do you have any stress? And of course, I was so used to it, I'd say no. I left on March 25th in 2012. About 3 months later, I noticed that I no longer had eczema, and it's never come back.
Let me ask you, Ron, and redirect the conversation a little bit to the way knowledge reports are used in Scientology. And as I understand it, a knowledge report is a report that a Scientologist writes out and sends up the authority lines to his or her superiors. And that one of the tenets is that if you don't report the condition that somebody else is in, then you're going to get the condition, meaning that you're going to have to go to ethics and be disciplined and get punished. And that all of that tends to foster what I would call a snitch culture. And there's a snitch culture in Scientology where nobody can really trust anybody else because everybody's busy writing knowledge reports because they're afraid if they don't, they're going to be punished.
Well, you're saying it probably better than I could. I mean, that's it. That's it. And I'll tell you.
Do I get a cigar?
Yeah, listen, I'm not going to say it because this is going to go on the air. I can't say it. That's all right. You said it.
Yeah.
You said it. And it is a snitch culture. And a lot of people, because of this, will have a forced smile on, oh, yeah, aren't things great? Oh, yeah, it's wonderful. And then maybe to their wife, who some of them can't even trust, they'll say, Jesus Christ, man, we got to get out of here one of these days, you know?
Well, and that smile.
There's wives that have turned in their husbands for saying this.
Right, right. Well, that smile, that goes along, what is it called, good roads, fair weather?
Exactly.
And yep. And so good roads and fair weather, that in turn can be related to what's called a shore story, which is basically telling a lie in order to get out of deep shit or potentially deep shit, right?
Not quite. And I'll tell you how the shore story came about. It was when the ship was in the Caribbean, when L. Ron Hubbard was aboard. The people on the ship, when they'd go on shore, they would say they were training to be managers or they were working for this corporation. That was called a shore story, but it in fact was a lie. And that's how it went. That's where that line developed. And like when I first went to Gold in 1985, the shore story about where I was, Christ, I even forget it now, but I know there was a shore story that there was a reason I was there, but it wasn't to be part of a Scientology group.
And didn't Reverend Moon call that heavenly deception?
Yeah, Moon did call that heavenly perception. Deception. One other thing I wanted to fill in a little bit. You've mentioned the name Mike Rinder a couple of times during the course of this. And for the benefit of the audience, Mike Rinder for a long time was the PR, the public relations guy for Scientology, and he was a Sea Org member. He was pretty high up in the hierarchy, and he's left the group along with a guy named Mark or Marty Rathbun, who similarly was very high in the group. And I remember when I was litigating, fighting it out hammer and tong with Scientology, those were the guys who were among the leaders that would go to court and that would sit in at depositions and that would give orders for me to be surveilled and do stuff like that. And now they're out and blowing the whistle and confirming all of the kinds of stuff that we're talking about and what Scientology does to them. And I think what Scientology has done to you is to then say that you're an apostate and that you're like a scorned woman or a scorned wife. And you're going to talk all kinds of nasty shit about your former spouse just because you're bitter and vitriolic, not because what you're saying is true. Isn't that right?
That's exactly right. And I'll tell you this, just so we don't get too far off my major point in writing the book, and that was to strike a body blow against the toxic policy of disconnection. And if they did that, I can tell you, let's say Scientology went by the wayside. There will always be something called whatever that's going to operate that way. It's not going to be the end of it. We both know that.
Oh, yeah.
And it just isn't going to end. All bad things are, you know, some people calling themselves a religion and they want to line their own pockets with money for whatever reason. But I'm very much interested in my daughters talking to me again, and my grandchildren and my great grandchildren. And I'm very much interested in getting other people who's this been done to. And I know this because of my position being David's father. I know I could do a blog and I'd probably get some thousands of people to read it. I knew that if I did a book that was very fair-handed, you know, not an attack, and I don't think the book comes off that way. It's more of an exposure of how things were and truthful. If I did that, I could get millions of people because I'd be on the air with either television or radio shows. And that is the reason I did it. And I'm telling you what goes on in that church. As far as I'm concerned, if they made all of Scientology technology public and you could get it, there are organizations that are run by private individuals outside the church that deliver Scientology services for a minuscule of the price that Scientology charges. There's no disconnection policy with them, and you don't have all the other agendas that you have to abide to, mm-hmm. abide by. It would then live and die by the workability and the helpfulness it would give to mankind in general. That's the way I think it should happen. But mainly, I just want to see disconnection knocked in the goddamn head. All right.
What do you think about the billboard that's been that's up there in L.A. Exhorting people to learn about Scientology's disconnection policy?
I think it's a fabulous idea, Will and Philly Jones. I knew their daughter. Their daughter worked at Golden Era Productions for a while. She was a steward for David.
Yeah.
Ron, one of the things that I found curious about the book, and just a little background, I believe that David's battle with the Internal Revenue Service to win religious tax-exempt status is a major sequence of events. There was a lot of threatening and bullying tactics that Scientology used, including inserting some people into the Internal Revenue Service to try to get a friendly result. And you really just talk about it in passing. I think you make one reference to it. Is that because you just didn't have much awareness of it in your position, or that you didn't consider it to be a significant phase of the church's history?
Well, look, I think it was very important for David to win that. Why I did it? Well, it was just how I felt at the time, that I didn't want it to be something to go tangential. Am I using the right word?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The actual purpose. And I didn't know if that would enhance it or detract from what I was trying to say. That's the only reason I did that.
All right. Well, then, if I may, just briefly tell us your thoughts about how that whole struggle was conducted. And it's really, you know, Scientology declared war on the Internal Revenue Service.
Okay, I can tell it in one breath. And that is this. There were literally hundreds of Scientologists who sued the IRS. And all these suits were going on. And it was made known to the IRS that if they gave the tax exemption, that all those suits could be turned off. And an executive there said to somebody who was there at the time, could this really happen? They said yes. They stopped all the suits, and that led to the agreement.
Ron, now, also what?
Wait, before you go on, because my voice is going to be on the air saying this. I don't have that firsthand from talking to the person who said it. That's at best secondhand, but I believe that it's true.
I understand. And it didn't Scientology also, in conjunction with those hundreds of lawsuits, also sick PIs on people who were high up in the IRS to dig through their records, dig through whether or not they're having extramarital affairs, dig through whether they had, misrepresented their financial status and applications under penalty of perjury for loans and that sort of thing, which was standard for how Scientology would conduct litigation?
Okay, and I don't know that to be true personally. But you know what? I don't doubt it, because it was done to me. Here, I'll give you an example. This is in a thing called Ability, which is a major magazine, and it's called The Scientologist. You see that?
Yeah.
and A Manual on the Dissemination of Material by L. Ron Hubbard. And this is in the books on organization. If you go to page 157, and this is the sixth paragraph down, it's the seventh page in on that particular magazine. And the last thing it says, the law can be used very easily to harass, and enough harassment on somebody who is simply on the thin edge anyway, well knowing that he is not authorized, will generally be sufficient to cause his professional decease. If possible, of course, ruin him utterly.
Right, and that's I know from personal experience, that is Scientology's litigation policy.
Exactly, and then there's another policy letter dated 15 August 1960, Department of Government Affairs.
Yep, London. Dateline, yeah. London. Uh-huh. Go ahead.
And on the second page in, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, the eighth paragraph down. It says, always find or manufacture enough threat against them to cause them to sue for peace. I'll say it again. Always find or manufacture enough threat against them to cause them to sue for peace.
Yep.
And so these were things that Hubbard wrote. Your son didn't write these. Hubbard wrote these.
That's correct. So what I'm saying is it was built in their DNA to keep this going. I mean, you know, you don't have the DNA of a tomato and you're going to turn out to be an oak tree. That is the thing that determines your course of action, either as a material object, organic, of course, or how you're going to operate as a group. And that was written by L. Ron Hubbard.
And so, Ron, as you look at your son, who you describe as ruthless in the title of your book, is he merely channeling L. Ron Hubbard and carrying out the wide array of directives and standards that Hubbard established?
I think to a large degree he is. Although I'll tell you this, guys, and I mentioned this to you earlier and I mentioned it in the book, the acquisition of power is like a drug. Tell you, you get used to that, and now he's hanging out with the glitterati of Hollywood, and you know, you get into that level, you don't want to sit down to some knockwurst and baked beans for a meal. You want to have your caviar and some pheasant or something, you know, and you live that life. You just don't want to get off it.
Do you think you'll ever get your son back?
Okay, I'll answer it this way. I think the only time you fail is when you stop trying. I think that's really the only time you really fail. And I'm going to keep trying. And I hope someday that would happen. And I hope someday my daughters will talk to me again, and my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren. And I hope for other people the same thing would happen to them. They can reunite with their families. We're talking about the building block of civilization. That's why I consider it a major crime that this disconnection policy is enforced by the church.
Ron, so, do you regret?
If we ever get back together again, let me tell you this.
Yeah.
I wouldn't put a whole lot of money on it right now, but God damn it, I'd like to see it happen.
All right. And do you regret introducing David to Scientology?
No. Because... No. I mean, look, life is here. Let's put it this way. I don't know if you know this, but I'm sure you do because you guys aren't 17 years old or anything. Hindsight is absolutely 20/20. You know, listen, you can be, I can be a post-dictor, you know, after the fact. I'll give you the winning score at the last year's Super Bowl, 100% accuracy, you know? And you can look back and say, well, if I would have only known it. No, based on what I knew at the time, I made the correct decision, I thought. And I can't live a life of regret because the end result of regretting is having regretted something. All I can do is go forward in time, try to lead a better life, try to help as many people as I can, and that's what I'm doing. That's how I'm living my life right now.
Ron Miscavige, it's been a real pleasure talking with you, and I want to, before we wrap up, give you an opportunity to add anything that we didn't cover or correct anything that you might think we've left a misimpression with.
Well, I'll tell you this, and not for my benefit, but I think by and large, people owe it to themselves to read this book. I think it's going to be helpful in many ways, other than just reading a book about Scientology or my experience with it. I think there's far more reaching effects that it'll have for a person and would be beneficial to them. And everybody out there, hey, you guys have a nice day. God bless all of you.
Ron Miscavige, the new book is called Ruthless, subtitled Scientology, My Son David Miscavige, and Me. Thank you for a very frank conversation, Ron.
Good to meet you, Ron.
Great meeting you guys, too, and thank you for having me on.
Please share this podcast as far and wide as you can. Put it up on Facebook and click that like button, will you? I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.